Hello everybody, I'm Jacopo Dettoni and this is the FDI Podcast. The month of May is traditionally the time for the members of the Asian Development Bank and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development to reconvene and catch up over the challenges lying ahead for the two development banks. I was in Manila at the beginning of the month to cover the ADB's annual meeting, whereas my colleague Adrian Klasa, who is here with me today, was in Jordan a week later to attend the EBRD's annual meeting. So Adrian, what have been your main takeaways from the event?
Thanks, Jacopo. I guess there were a couple main themes that emerged. First of all, from a top-line economic perspective, the EBRD's chief economist seemed to be quite optimistic for the growth outlook for all the countries that they cover. However, there were some concerns about rising corporate debt levels and also ceilings placed on growth by the lack of structural reforms that were going to be seen in some countries. In terms of the themes that were really being and the issues that were really being discussed at the meeting, though, one of the central ones is the fact that the EBRD is looking to grow. It's looking to expand its the countries it covers in the regions that it's already in and to sort of maybe even look outward from there because it has additional capital to deploy. The second one was the EBRD sort of aligning itself with sort of China's Belt and Road policy drive, which wants to see sort of infrastructure linking Europe and Asia sort of built all across the belt that used to be the Silk Road back in the days of Marco Polo and such. And I guess the third thing that came out was sort of really looking at the work that the EBRD was starting to do in some of the new countries that it had expanded into, notably Jordan, which is a recent addition.
Well, actually, it's interesting that you mentioned the future of the EBRD, the expansion of the EBRD. This was also a topic for the ADB in Manila because the ADB is sort of in a different situation. They are sort of struggling to remain relevant because the region has experienced so much growth over the past decades. Another main topics were definitely like automation, innovation. So the Asia-Pacific region, the region of operation, typical region of operation of the ADB, obviously is a big manufacturing hub for the whole world, and now they are facing this huge opportunity but also challenge of automation, AI, and so many countries that have bet much of their development over manufacturing and other services like call center. Now they are wondering what's next, what should we do with also from a policy making perspective to address this, to make the most of these opportunities but also address these challenges on from a work perspective. But tell us something more about the expansion of the EBRD. This is definitely a very interesting a topic. The EBRD has grown much farther beyond the typical era of operation of Eastern Europe or which was originally established. So what's next for the EBRD?
Right. So, I mean, the EBRD was initially set up, as many listeners will know, to help post-Soviet states move towards democracy and market economies. Now that a lot of that's been accomplished, the EBRD has looked to expand across the Mediterranean basin. So they've looked at what they call the SEMED, the Southern and Eastern Mediterranean group of countries that they've sort of drawn a circle around the Mediterranean to encircle. So that includes places like Turkey, that includes places like Jordan. And now they're sort of looking to potentially invest in even more countries across that region. That reflects the fact that, you know, the EBRD has a mission that is looking to support the Sustainable Development Goals. That also has to do with the fact that, as I mentioned previously, the EBRD actually has spare cash lying around. They say that they have an additional €3 billion worth of capital that they could look to invest. So obviously they're going to look first in their countries of operation where they already are, but then they're going to start looking to expand outwards. Why don't we listen to, I've got a clip with Jonathan Charles, who is the head of communications for EBRD, sort of talking about their expansion plan and see what he has to say about it.
As MDBs, multilateral development banks, we all need to step up to tackle this, and we all need to do more, and that includes the EBRD. So we will be reminding governors that we could do, because we have plenty of capital, we're not short of capital to tackle these issues. We just had the World Bank having more capital, a recapitalization that seems to be going through, but we have capital. And we could do another 3 billion euros a year of lending on top of the, on average, 9.4 billion that we've done over the past few years. So we could take our lending to 12, 12.5 billion or something like that. So the question is what to do with that. It's how to harness that really to help to deliver these against these three challenges. So we want a discussion tomorrow with our shareholders. We're not going to ask them for a decision. It's really just get a sense of their where they stand on this. So no formal decision making, but actually with the sense of where they stand, we will then proceed with whatever we need to do. And we are asking them to consider and to discuss tomorrow a phased approach.
So the key message here is that the EBRD has got capital to deploy, and they are looking at ways to the new ways to deploy it, right?
Yeah, the interesting thing actually is, so I interviewed Jonathan on the day before the big sort of shareholders forum of the EBRD. The day after, there was a press conference with the president of the EBRD where sort of this consultation process that he was talking about with existing members took place in terms of, you know, what do we want to look at doing? So Jonathan talked about sort of, you know, a three-stage approach. And once President Chakrabarty was sort of making its statement, his statements, it came across that perhaps some of the existing members had hesitations about sort of the EBRD looking to expand even further. And it should be noted that, you know, some of the markets that they're talking about expanding into in phase two include places like Syria, Iraq, Algeria. Interesting markets, very, very challenging. Obviously, you know, both Libya and Syria are not at peace at the moment. So I think that there was perhaps some hesitation about, you know, how quickly they should push ahead with this.
But in a way, this would anyway also fit any European Union agenda to start increase help for these countries locally instead of kind of trying to weather the storm of, for example, the immigration crisis, the migrant crisis in Europe when it's already happening, trying to increase, support locally, which is an old mantra, for example, of the British government, but it's always kind of a struggle to gain any real traction also because obviously local dynamics are more difficult to be dealt with from a European institution bank perspective.
Definitely. I mean, I think that the subtext to a lot of this expansion is the migration issue. Obviously, officials were somewhat hesitant to sort of talk about that as being the primary motivator. But in terms of a lot of the countries they're looking at, and perhaps, you know, in phase three, even looking to start investing more in sub-Saharan Africa, it does kind of follow the patterns of migrant flows that we're seeing into Europe that are creating so many policy problems there.
Right. Well, actually, the ADB was, again, as I mentioned, it was a complete different sort of sentiment because the Asia-Pacific region has experienced tremendous achievements in terms of reducing, for example, extreme poverty. I pulled the statistics. Extreme poverty decreased from 53% of total population in the Asia-Pacific region from in 1990 to 9% in 2013. And obviously, as a development bank with a huge main focus on reducing extreme poverty in the region, the ADB is now sort of left left to wonder what's next now. So definitely one of their answers is to go farther beyond the typical Asia-Pacific region. So now they are definitely increasing operation in South Asia, countries like Bangladesh, Pakistan, also India. Definitely increasing also their operations in Central Asia and the Caucasus, like again countries like Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, where also the EBRD is doing actually a lot of work, also Azerbaijan or Georgia. But also they want to take like a lead in terms of like in terms of policy advice and in terms of helping local governments to incorporate innovation, new technologies in their policy making. So one of the examples that President Akhau made in an interview we had was how they help Bangladesh to improve their the technology of their water distribution system to reduce leakages, to improve metering, to improve revenue collections from tax from water usage bills and so on and so forth. So they are trying in a way to reinvent themselves, and they are framing everything in what they call the 2030 strategy, which is a document that is already, is still under assessment, has yet to be fully approved by all the members. But that obviously the annual meeting in Manila was definitely a big opportunity for them to discuss this internally, to discuss the first draft internally. And then obviously, as you mentioned, the Belt and Road Initiative, they are also being active both in East Asia, in China, but also increasing that in South Asia and Central Asia. They definitely embrace the narrative of the Belt and Road Initiative. They did in the last couple of years, they did a lot of co-financing with the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And this is definitely will become an increasing, rising and a more important area of importance for the bank, as it has become also for the EBRD, right?
Yes, definitely. I mean, EBRD very much sees itself as being aligned with the Belt and Road Initiative. I mean, the deputy governor of the People's Bank of China, the central bank, was actually at the EBRD to talk about the Belt and Road Initiative. I think that, you know, a lot of the EBRD's countries already overlap with the countries that are seen as key to Belt and Road, sort of running through Central Asia, running through the Caucasus. So that very much aligns. And there's also the fact that it does align with the EBRD's core principles, you know, looking at sort of developing these interlinkages. That being said, you know, they still see a lot of challenges. I'm sure that the ADB does as well, in terms of, you know, there have been questions about the quality of some of the infrastructure and investments that have been made across sort of Belt and Road initiatives. There have been questions about debt sustainability, and this has been actually an issue that really the IMF and Christine Lagarde have been starting to sort of thump about quite loudly across the emerging world. We are seeing sort of, you know, an uptick in debt. In the statements that Chen Yulu, sort of the deputy governor of the Bank of China, made at the EBRD, he actually acknowledged this and sort of said that, you know, China in pushing forward, more Belt and Road investments would be keeping a close eye on sort of how this impacts debt sustainability across the countries they're working in. It's an interesting push and one that I'm sure that we'll be seeing a lot more of going forward.
Yeah, a typical example of what you're mentioning about like debt sustainability is probably Sri Lanka, which is a country that is always well featured also at the annual event of the ADB, that took on a lot of debt to develop the Belt and Road sort of projects in Sri Lanka, a specific big port on the southern coast of the island, the Ambantota port, and another few projects also in Colombo. And these projects are really struggling to live up to original expectations. The Ambantota port is a postcard for sort of a failed Belt and Road project, because the port is always sort of empty, doesn't get any cargo traffic. And the airport that was developed next to it is also an international airport, basically in the middle of nowhere. There are very few international flights coming in and out at the moment, no traffic at all. So again, it's interesting, because in the past couple of years at ADB annual meeting, there was a lot of talking about Belt and Road Initiative. This year, I felt that it was for them a moment to sort of clean house, try to figure out where we are today after this big, big initial push, try to put things in order, and try also from our development finance perspective, try to figure out what's the best way forward. So in a way, not that they pulled the brakes, but they, for this year, it was kind of a lower profile than in previous years. Also because there is a perception that the competition between the ADB and the AIIB is sort of intensifying. People at the meeting told me that it's easier today for the private sector to get financing from the AIIB, whereas it's more difficult to get financing from an ADB. Actually, the ADB has always been focused on more kind of sovereign finance, Now they are trying to increase private financing to the private sector because I feel they see the rise of the AIIB, but also the EBRD, so development banks that are exclusively focused on private sector financing, and this is kind of a sort of competition. Source of competition for them.
I think that's a really interesting point because, yeah, I think that the complementarity between the EBRD's private sector focus and private sector experience was really something that they were seeking to emphasize for Belt and Road projects at this year's meeting. I think another really notable thing, though, that came out for me from sort of the discussions about Belt and Road was how strongly the representatives of both the Bank of China, but also of sort of, you know, other Chinese entities there wanted to push this idea of China as a leader of globalization and China acting against protectionism, China as sort of, you know, the opening up versus, they didn't say the U.S., but this was obviously the implication, versus the U.S.'s sort of pulling away from the rest of the world. So as well as being obviously, you know, an initiative that's focused on sort of developing business, developing investment, there was a very clear political line that was being drawn in the sand as well.
And I guess this is, I mean, you can read it from different perspective, but it's definitely clever and probably opportunistic policy in a way to come up as a champion of free trade and globalization right now that the US is sort of more turning towards protectionism or anyway it's more attentive free trade policies with obviously the President Donald Trump. So this is perceived obviously in Asia, obviously in Europe and the Middle East, but also, for example, Latin America was recently Latin America and Panama, and there is happening exactly the same. China is pushing to close deals to emphasizing this kind of global trade characteristic of the new course of the Xi Jinping presidency. But the big question mark there is, I guess, is the lingering question mark is, will there be ever a political price for these countries to pay sooner or later for embracing the Belt and Road initiative?
Sure. And also, what does it mean for us all globally when we have essentially a communist country leading globalization? I mean, this is the major shift that we're going to see across all facets of politics and economics in the next little while.
Right. But let me spend a couple of more words on something that was touched specifically, another major topic that was touched specifically there in Manila at the ADB meeting, that was innovation and automation. Again, as mentioned, many of these countries in Southeast Asia have become the manufacturing hubs for the whole world. But now there is this major technological disruption that is putting a thousand, if not millions, of jobs at risk. There are obviously different views on what will be the impact of automation, robotics, AI on the job market. The ADB came out with a very interesting and insightful research on this, and they tend to be very optimistic on what this all means for the job market, in a way that they recognize that there will be people displaced, jobs displaced by technology and automation. But at the same time, their conclusion is that there will also be new sectors rising from new sectors sort of related to technology and innovation, and also kind of the growing aggregate demand, the growing wealth of the overall region will in a way have an effect to offset the impact of automation on the job market. This was, again, they themselves were very vocal in defining this their approach as optimistic. I felt that the private sector is much less optimistic, or in a way is more realistic. I think that those who are really implementing like automation on the ground, and they have a real grasp of the figures and the numbers, they tend to be like more like, no, there will be many, many jobs to be displaced, and it's going to be tough to replace them. And also from a policy perspective, I felt that also local governments well, some local governments in the region, they are also, they have to be more realistic in terms of what this all means also from a policymaking perspective. And here I spoke to Mr. Bambang Brojonegoro, who is the Minister of National Development Planning of Indonesia, and write about this, and this is what he told me.
More on the issue of manufacturing. In the manufacturing, of course, with the digitalization, Industrial Revolution 4.0, automation is everywhere. Automation is everywhere, and certainly there will be, I think, quite significant amount of labor replaced by the machine, or at the more extreme level, the robot. But when we are talking about services sector, which is also one important part of our economy, the story is a bit different. The story is, of course, the emergence of the digital economy through the advanced technology actually has the potential to create new job opportunities. From policy perspective, we would like to still keep encourage, the emergence of the startups. And we also pursue for the startups that, we will pursue for the startup that really has the opportunity to create the jobs rather than just, exchanging or replacing the existing jobs.
And it's interesting here that one of the examples that people in the region tend to mention often is Uber. Uber is tends to be very controversial in Europe or in the US for many different reasons. But in the Asia-Pacific region, Uber is perceived as an innovation that gave thousands of people the chance to get a job, to come out of informality in a way, to get a job, and also to get kind of decent wages, to get an insurance number, to formalize their situation in the job market. And so there is definitely a different perception. But at the same time, I feel like Uber is also a company that is investing million in driverless cars. So sooner or later, they will need probably less and less drivers if their testing on driverless cars works out as they expect it to work out.
So the robots are coming for all of us. But whenever I hear conversations about the fourth industrial revolution, the coming of automation, the death of traditional job markets, I wonder, is this conversation premature? Because this is obviously something that emotionally we're all a little frightened by. I mean, did you get a sense talking to people at the ADB how quickly they think that this is coming?
Well, that's a very good point. I think that most of the people that are in policy making, policy advice, or like external observers, they really don't get, they don't really understand at the fullest how quick this is happening. I think that when you speak to people in the private sectors, to manufacturers, to people that are in electronics, automotive, garments, generally there you get a perception that things are happening really, really, really quickly. And the push for this, for the incentive for this company is to keep going that direction. And they will go, they are all in for automation because obviously it's a global market and competition is stiff. So, the more productive, the more efficient you are, the better you are. And there are technology. China is investing $1 billion every year in robotics and automation. Also AI, don't forget AI. For example, a country like the Philippines where 1.2 million of people, if not more, work in call centers. And most of these people, they could likely be replaced by artificial intelligence machines in the next few years. And it's already happening. Actually, when I was in Manila, people were telling me that call centers were emptying office buildings and they were replaced by e-gambling Chinese companies. So I think that it's already happening. And where I see a consensus also from those who have optimistic views like the ADB is that there will be a transition. Let's see, the positive view is that, okay, there will be a transition. We can retrain, reskill workers to be ready to embrace, to get new jobs in the new economy, new sectors that will be out there once innovation get full traction. So this is definitely something, there is definitely consensus on the fact that there will be, there needs to be policies, education policies tailored for this new rising economy, but also redistribution policies to support those that maybe haven't got access to technology, those who haven't got anyway the skills or the age to adjust. Imagine, like, we are still talking of a region where, for example, power is still a major issue. Like I was recently writing about Papua New Guinea, which is the main economy in the Asia Pacific Islands, and 85%, if not 90% of the people lack access to power. So all of them, 90% of the population, is not participating in this innovation revolution because they just don't have access to power. So it's a massive challenge.
I think it's also worrying because, you know, I've spent the past couple of years reporting a lot from sub-Saharan Africa, and these are parts of the world that are kind of banking on the fact that actually a lot of light manufacturing is going, as labor costs go up in Asia, in Vietnam, in places that the ADB is covering that are developing very quickly, those jobs are going to need to go elsewhere. We're going to industrialize in places like Ghana and Ethiopia and South Africa, and we're going to set up those factories here. Now, if automation is coming as quickly as you say, they might miss out on that. There might be a jump that sort of precludes that kind of industrialization policy. So I think that that's concerning for policymakers there.
Right. Well, actually, there is also a lot of talking about reshoring. I mean, some people argue that automation can create a case for European or American company to reshore their manufacturing capacity within Europe or the US, which from this perspective, I feel that, again, I don't buy it. You know, I think that this won't completely happen for the simple reason that the Asia Pacific market by itself has become such a big market that any producer want to have a manufacturing capacity there because the consumers of the future and also consumers of the present are there. So probably they might be in a condition to reshore some of the production bound for their local markets in Europe, the US, or wherever, but definitely there will be still a huge manufacturing capacity installed in Southeast Asia. But the point that you make about Africa is definitely a very good one. It's will there be an economic case? Will there still be an economic case for manufacturers to move capacity to African countries for like labor cost advantages in the future?
We shall see. We shall see. But they are, you know, many economies in the African region are investing heavily in this. So if the fourth industrial revolution comes too quickly, it's gonna throw a wrench in those plans.
But Adrian, so tell us something more about Jordan. If we let's move on and let's talk. Jordan was it's an interesting country. Jordan, the EBRD has been operating in Jordan now for a few years. It sounds like a bit of a statement, strong statement to have an annual meeting there in Jordan. So what's your view on what's happening in Jordan and how the EBRD is sort of supporting development in the country?
Well, Jordan's interesting, and it's interesting in a certain way that the EBRD is there because, I mean, as much as they say this is part of their sort of southern eastern Mediterranean region, I mean, Jordan doesn't actually border on that. It's sort of, you know, to the east of that. But, I mean, currently they have about a 780 million euro portfolio active in the country. They're looking very heavily at renewable energy. They're also looking very heavily at water and water resilient projects. So Jordan is the second most water stressed country in the world. That is linked to climate change to a certain extent. It's also very much linked to the fact that Jordan has capacity or sort of water reserves that should be supporting a population of about 2 million people. There are currently 9.5 million people in Jordan surviving on very, very, very little water. Population growth is part of that. A lot of that has to do with refugee flows, right, both out of Palestine. It borders on Palestine and Israel. And those have been coming in since 1948, since the Israeli state was created. But it also has to do with wars in neighboring Iraq and Syria. And those conflicts have put incredible strain on Jordan's water resilience. They've also put a lot of strain on the economy in general. The closure of the Syrian border with Jordan at the height of the conflict, it still remains closed today, you know, has really shut down trade to a certain extent. So, you know, Jordan is resilient, but it is struggling to a certain extent. And there are also questions as to, you know, how much space is actually being created for the private sector to come in and sort of really make investments and really be able to take initiative, as opposed to sort of being blockaded both by multilateral development banks, but also by their own policymakers. I have a clip here, actually, by Basim El Saleh, who's an investor from a clean energy and renewable technology company called Green Tech. So maybe we can listen to that now and see what he has to say.
I would say we still need some work. We are on the right track. For example, on the renewable energy side, the legislation and regulation is really advanced in Jordan. I would say, and I think there are statistics that per capita shows Jordan to be one of the first countries in the world in solar installations. So they are doing it on one side. What needs to happen is, I think, more promotion of private sector-led initiatives, and not just by government. Even DFIs, I was just talking on the panel, development organizations such as the ABRD should allow private sector-led initiatives to go without the obstacle of having to bid everything out. So if I come into that to the ABRD with an idea that makes sense, financial sense to them, to us, and has the value of civil society promotion and advancement, they should take it. I mean, they can vet it, they can run due diligence on it, but they cannot just stop it, which is what they do today, because it's not through a bidding process.
So as you can see there, the private sector is interested in getting involved in sort of solving a lot of Jordan's problems, but there are still some obstacles to that. I think another really interesting thing actually that came out in my discussion with various Jordanian officials there is the fact that Jordan is now positioning itself to be able to basically capitalize on the reconstruction efforts that are going to happen in Iraq and Syria once the conflicts there end, to the extent that the Jordanian government is even setting up special economic zones specifically geared towards the companies and the investors that are going to need to come in to rebuild these two countries. We also have a clip of my interview with the minister. Maybe let's play that now and see what he has to say about that.
Geographically, it is important for us to pay attention to the rebuilding process. What's being done to create the proper tool to take advantage of that? We've created a development zone in Mafraq. We created also a logistical hub there. Mafraq is 15 kilometers away from Syria, 200 kilometers away from Iraq. We have built a relation between the military and the free zone area and company called Safeport to create also a proper runway into the development zone, whereby you would create a logistical platform that has a proper infrastructure. Also, you want to give it the capability of accessibility through air. That area has a very good incentive program, such as income tax is only 5%, sales tax on goods and services important for the business, it's zero, and it has a list of zeros.
So obviously this is very interesting. The situation though in Syria and parts in Iraq remains as complicated as ever. So did you feel, you know, in your conversation also with like private sector people, did you feel that there is real interest for private sector, for private companies to participate in this, well, actually to start moving towards a possible rebuilding of Syria and Iraq, or still is too much of a risky play at the moment?
I mean, I think it's still too unstable to start thinking about that now. But, you know, there's already a large, let's say, community of investors who already did this the last time around. You know, this is the second time we're rebuilding Iraq since 2000. Right. So I think that there will be interest in doing that in particular, you know, as investors are all too fond of saying, you know, where there is challenge, there is opportunity. You know, this special economic zone and this sort of push by the Jordanians is quite new, but I would imagine that there are many who will look to take advantage of that in the coming years and as the situation in both Syria and Iraq stabilizes.
Okay, let me finish with another very last topic that was discussed, even though not as much as I would have expected there in Manila, which is cryptocurrencies, and anyway, the surge, the emergence of blockchain as this kind of disruptive technology, also, if not above all, for finance. I spoke there to Mamuka Bakhtadze, who is a finance minister for Georgia, because Georgia, interestingly enough, is emerging as a superpower for crypto mining. There are certain estimates that says that after China, we all know about like the crypto mining farms in China, but after China, the country that is mining the most bitcoins and Ethereum and so on and so forth has become now Georgia. This obviously we have to handle these statistics carefully, but definitely is becoming like a hotspot for companies looking to mine cryptocurrencies. And obviously this creates big opportunities for the country. So this is investment for the country. But obviously this creates challenges, power consumption, and so on and so forth. And this is what he told me specifically about regulation of cryptocurrencies.
According to some studies, Georgia is number two or three in the world in terms of crypto mining. Even in today's meeting, this was one of the main topic, and there's generally the topic about cryptocurrencies it has become very popular. Of course, I mean, our position is that the industry of crypto mining has been growing in the last couple of years. 10 days ago, we had the spring meetings in Washington, and there's the same spirit actually here in Manila during ADB annual summit, that there should be some kind of rules of game on international level. Okay, because we see that now more and more countries are trying to implement or craft their own national strategies about cryptocurrencies, and we are closely monitoring that. But however, we think that there should be some rules of games, not only on national but on international level, because this sector has become actually pretty large. That's a fact, and I think that the industry needs new rules of game.
Okay, so new rules of game. Somebody would argue that rules of game, they just go against the principle of the blockchain itself, which is this decentralized ledger technology. But obviously from a policymaking perspective, definitely from their perspective, would make sense to have some sort of international consensus over basic questions like, do we want cryptocurrencies? Do we allow cryptocurrencies? Do we want to regulate them more or less? So this is definitely something that matters for countries that are experiencing this kind of development within their borders. Okay, Adrian, well, thank you. Thank you very much for being with us today. Let me ask you a very last question. Looking at next year's EBRD meeting, is there any specific theme or topic that you would expect to become more prominent next year or in the following year's meetings?
I think that the big thing that everybody knows is going to happen next year now is that's when you're going to have sort of the outcome of consultations with shareholders on the expansion of the EBRD. So they're going to conclude that for the 2019 meeting in Sarajevo and sort of make decisions about geographically where the bank is going next. So that will be definitely happening then. And then what I would also expect is, you know, again, this was sort of a veiled theme that wasn't addressed head on. But, you know, migration into Europe is going to be an ongoing issue that the European Union and therefore the EBRD and associated institutions are going to be dealing with. And I hope that there can be a more, let's say, transparent discussion of sort of how European policy on migration and also investment policy coming out of EBRD, EIB, and all of these different bodies is looking at these issues.
Right. I think that with regards to the ADB, I think that the next year's location is again sort of symbolic of something, an emerging thing that will become more prominent in the next few years. So next year the meeting will be in Fiji. And so I think that they definitely want to increase their leverage, their operations in the Pacific Islands. And I would definitely expect themes like cryptocurrencies, but also cybersecurity is applied to finance and development finance to become to get like the center stage of the annual summit.
Also, everybody just wants a tan.
Definitely. Well, Jen, thanks again for being with us. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can follow all our podcasts on fdiintelligence.com/podcast or on Acast and iTunes. Until the next time.